Very Bad Wizards is a podcast with a philosopher, my dad, and a psychologist, Dave Pizarro, having an informal discussion about issues in science and ethics. Please note that the discussion contains bad words that I'm not allowed to say, and knowing my dad, some very inappropriate jokes.
We, in comparison to that enormous articulation, we only sound and look like badly pronounced and half-finished sentences out of a stupid suburban novel.
The great end boss has spoken. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Who are you? Who are you?
A very bad man.
I'm a very good man. Good man.
Very bad wizard.
Welcome to Very Bad Wizards. I'm Tamler Summers from the University of Houston. Dave, my long national nightmare is finally over. My house once again has a dog in it. Can you guess?
Holy sh!
Yeah, I know. I didn't tell you yet.
What the fuck? Yeah. This is like, I'm literally hearing this for the first time. I interrupted your question though. Okay, what?
Can you guess what her name is? That was the question.
Ann Coulter. I don't know.
Really? That's...
I don't know. It was just on my mind.
What is this? Like 2006 or something like that? That was not...
Little Kim. How about Little Kim? Little Kim.
It's Little Kim. No, no, it's Trixie.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
For our Ambulators listeners, definitely played a role in it. So, yeah. I haven't even said, because I hadn't been ready to speak about it publicly, but Charlie died a couple months ago, soon after Omar did. And it was just like, I had already talked about Omar, gotten a lot of nice, you know, well wishes, and I couldn't just do that all over again for Charlie. And it was honestly, it was just horrible. Like, to have, to go from a, like, I hadn't lived in a house without a dog in 25 years, 26 years or something like that. Wow. And then all of a sudden it's just gone empty, but no more. We went to the SPCA. I wasn't even the one that, like, kind of drove it. Eliza was home for the weekend, and just like, her and Jen just said, let's go to the let's just do this. You know, she's here, she'll have some kind of say in it. And we just came back with Trixie. I was like, are we sure we're ready? Like, I mean, you know, yeah.
That makes me so happy. That's the best news I've gotten all week. That's awesome, man. I'm happy for you. So what does she look like? How old is she? Like, what?
She's like 3.5 months. She's, they say, like a shepherd mix, but she just looks like a total mutt, like a, you know, like a little bit of everything. Stew, but she's black. She's got big ears. I think she's going to be about 50 pounds, hopefully. I'm a little worried she's too small, but she's young and she's fine. She's having a little potty training issues that we're working out this week. We've just had her for a few days, but
I remember when I had my dog at first and I was having potty training issues. I remember you weren't very patient with me. You told me, just keep him in the cage. Like, I don't know what's wrong. Like,
crate,
why? So that's what I'm going to tell you.
Yeah. Well, she, like, one of our issues is that she just shits it all over her crate.
Trixie! We got to get ready to start listening
that
to you yelp.
Yeah, she's
just
a total
don't beat her, man. Don't beat her.
I don't. That's never a problem. It's always the other end of the spectrum, the worry with me and a dog. At least it's not gay now, you know?
That's right. Yeah, you're normal.
But you know, I did feel a little bit like, but are we being disloyal to Charlie and Omar? You know, this is Charlie of shut the fuck up, Charlie. But you just got to move on. And it's just too depressing to come home and there's nobody in the house.
No, you know, I like to picture Charlie and Omar like a Darth Vader and Yoda when they were like ghosts.
Proudly.
They're
I like, that's
just
good.
Nodding.
Yeah.
I was going to use the technical term force ghosts, but I didn't think you would get it.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. I'm glad you over-explained, or for me, just explained. All right, what do we have on tap today? Enough of my life. In the second segment, we'll be digging into the differences, the often hostile differences between analytic and continental philosophy via a really good 2003 paper by Neil Levy, a veteran of the early 2000s free will and moral responsibility blogosphere. But first, the University of Austin. There's breaking news on the University of Austin, Texas. We had some fun talking about them back when Barry Weiss put out, it was like 3 years ago or something, like a kind of...
Yeah, it was only 2 years ago. I was looking this up.
No, it was 2021.
It feels like 4 years ago. Was it 2021?
Yeah.
November 2021.
She put out this article on her Substack introducing the University of Austin. The writer of that was Pano Canelos, who quit his job at, I don't know, some Catholic university in...
St. John's.
In Annapolis. Yeah, St. John's. Yeah. And it was like anti-woke university. We are going to have the conversations that don't happen in the woke academia right now.
And they had like that coming out post. And then when you'd go to their website, it was like all of these people, right? It was like Steve Pinker, Leon Cass, John Haidt, Glenn Lowry, Tyler Cowen. And it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, well, maybe this is not just a grift. Maybe this is.
Right. But they all almost immediately just withdrew their whatever association they have, you know, and some of them
they backed into that bush like Homer Simpson. Like all of a sudden they were just disappeared. It's just removed from the website.
Yeah. And I think it's because Pano, whatever, painted this picture of modern universities as some kind of Stalinist or Maoist regime that runs those places, and like it was so unreflective of the modern universities, like how it actually runs right now, that even all those people who have a lot of sympathy with the general like anti-social justice warriors, and to use the parlance of that era, but they just couldn't support it. They had to get out because they know they actually do teach it at these universities, and so they know. So anyway,
exactly.
one of the things we had fun like ridiculing them about was their idea of their summer school of forbidden courses. Right.
Right. Well, especially because like they announced immediately that they had plans to become a full-fledged university within like 2 years or whatever. You know, they were going to rapidly develop a curriculum, and it just seemed ridiculous that they could get that up and running, and that they announced these like on. Right. At first, it was like online forbidden courses, 2 week sessions. It was like, oh, yeah,
and they had no address. It was kind of the peak of that time where a lot of the, you know, like actual big time centrist anti-woke intellectuals like Pinker or Haidt or, you know, like that this was something they would get behind. And then I don't know why, it just landed with such a thud.
Yeah, we didn't hear anything about it for like a long time.
Not a peep. For like 2.5 years, blessed years.
Right. To be fair, not that we were checking regularly, I guess.
I guess, yeah. Like, I don't know where you would check. I feel like we read the things where they would That's be true. Announced. Yeah. Anyway, that has changed via an article that seems like it would be written only so we could talk about it. It's like an embedded reporter telling us about their experience in the scandalous summer series Forbidden Courses.
Gonzo journalism at its finest.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I was excited. We're going to get some fodder, an update about what's been going on. This guy actually signed up for one of the Forbidden Courses. He's going to tell us all about what it's like from the inside. It looks like they got some sort of Texas accreditation, you know, so that's an exciting update.
Yeah, it's very light on those kinds of details, which I would love to have known. But this is by Noah Rawlings is the author's name, and it's the journal New Inquiry, which I'm not familiar with. Yeah, and you know, one of us put it in the Slack. I honestly don't remember. We both just probably read the opening paragraph and thought, oh, this is too easy. But this was a huge disappointment for us. And we're going to make this in part about us and like our conflict. But like, imagine my surprise that this turns out to be a really hard thing to enjoy talking about because we have these two conflicting reactions, two things going on internally that it's very hard to know what to do with it. You know, like on the one hand, who could be more insufferable and just awesome to make fun of than like the University of Austin and the poor suckers who like signed up for their Forbidden Courses summer camp.
Right.
But on the other hand, the author, Jesus Christ, he's trying to do like a satire hatchet job and it's brutal. It's like, I feel like it's the opposite of how you should approach doing a piece like this.
It was like a twist, an M. Night Shyamalan twist for me. By the end, I was slightly more, I wouldn't say in favor.
You were a team, University of Austin.
Yeah, exactly. I was like buying their swag, you know. Having a little flag.
You're writing like a cover letter to be one of their summer guest speakers.
I mean, I was a little offended that they didn't ask me to be on the advisory board, but whatever.
Yeah. I don't think they like anti-Semites, though. That's the one you can't be.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
You can be like anti so pretty hard. Much anyone
it's so,
else.
It's so hard.
Hard out here so for an anti-Semite.
Exactly.
So the first few lines are, the University of Austin is not in Austin. Not yet. It's 200 miles northeast in Dallas on an office complex owned by Mr. Harlan Crow of Clarence Thomas. I give you gifts that are illegal, like in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Whenever I read that name, I feel like we should say Harlan Crow. Like Harlan Crow.
Right. He does sound like a noir villain who owns all the orange like groves or whatever.
But with foghorn leghorn in there.
Yeah, that's true. So it's kind of funny that we don't get any sense of when or even if they plan on actually locating in Austin, do we?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think so.
I didn't get a sense.
Yeah.
You know what I didn't get? Did they say how much it costs to take these courses?
No. But apparently they put out a call for students and to apply for their summer Forbidden Courses camp, and he applied and got in.
Cream of the crop.
Cream of the crop, as Peter Boghossian says. So Peter Boghossian, a friend of the podcast. We had James Lindsay, his co-author for that conceptual penis hoax on way back.
Along with Helen Pluckrose, the SoCal Squared fiasco.
What was it? The conceptual penis and something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. In a paper published journal. Those were the days, you know. He quit his job at Portland State or wherever he was. And I think like he was an instructional professor, and he's now a central figure at the University of Austin. And our author sat next to him on the bus to get to the complex. And, you know, like it starts out, it's a little annoying, but, you know, you feel like, oh, my God, this is going to be good, you know?
Right.
Like he starts talking to him about how you need to exercise as an intellectual. And then it gets to, you got to get into jiu-jitsu. Peter did jiu-jitsu. He says he could murder everybody on this bus and nobody could stop me. It's a superpower.
Yeah, which... See, just do people talk that way? You literally say, I could murder every single person on this bus.
It's like 50-50 for me whether like anything that is reported actually happened. Like some of it sounds right. Like I totally buy that he does jiu-jitsu. Like that is exactly for sure what those kinds of people do. But, you know.
Right. So, yes, I was on board at this point. I was like, haha, Peter Boghossian. Yeah.
Maybe a little wary, but on board. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the author is taking, of the four forbidden courses, Katie Royfe's sexual politics course. We can talk about some of the other courses that are on offer. But a big chunk of the next section is on the opening dinner and the lectures. And here's where I think both of us jumped ship from this article and realized this is going to be tough to figure out what to do with.
Do you have the very paragraph? Do you have it up?
Yeah, it's funny because we tried to record earlier on this and had to kind of abort. We had to pull the maybe we're going to have to again, but
no, we're going to tackle this.
We're going to get through it.
Yes.
I hope the listeners can understand just the forces that are opposing each other in our breasts. But
an intra-psychic tension.
A collision. So here's where we just decided, oh God, like this guy is kind of insufferable too. We were served some kind of marinated chicken and left to mingle. Us, the well-groomed top of the top. Us, the forbidden. Just don't do that. Just, okay, we'll talk about why this does.
Capital F forbidden.
We numbered 50 or so. We came from places like Harvard and Stanford and Chicago and MIT and UPenn. There was James, who studied computer science. There was Cameron, who also studied computer science. David and Peter studied computer science, while Luke and Albert studied computer science. As for Mike and Jason, the former studied computer science, whereas the latter studied computer science. Ethan was not unlike Max in that both studied computer science. Some people studied business, too.
Okay, I even dislike you a little bit just because you read it.
I wanna,
by the end,
part of this is also just an open call to our listeners to do this piece the right way, because the right way to do it isn't to try to, you know, indulge your satirical whimsy, your sense of yourself as like H.L. Mencken or Ogden Nash or something like that. No, just report what's going on. You have the University of, this is the easiest thing to make fun of, but you have to not put yourself into it. You have to let them do it. And this is all about this guy being clever and snide and smug to the point where I feel like I want to defend the University of Austin people, but I don't know.
If I had to describe, like, everything you're saying, right, is right about what he shouldn't be doing. It seems to me that just subtlety, just a little bit of subtlety, it is.
It's
putting a hat on a hat on a hat.
So then he talks about the student demographics, and not surprisingly, 80% of them are white, 70% over are men. I'm actually surprised there were that many women.
I know, right? Yeah.
What's going on with you if you're going to this and you're a woman? There was no black people there, zero. Again, not surprising.
There's a total of 50 people.
Then we get like the opening kind of lectures, the welcome to the inaugural class of the University of Austin Forbidden Courses Summer Series. And Paolo, or whoever.
You're so anti-Greek, you know?
I don't like the Greeks. I've never liked the Greeks. The author writes that he says, he told us we weren't starting a university, we were a university. In all but the literal sense of actually being a university. This is what a university looks like. People coming together for conversations, much like the ones we've been having over our complimentary chicken dinners. Dialogue, he said, from the Greek logos. Two rational beings. Again, this is like these two things, like which can be more annoying. Two rational beings engaged in rational discourse. He smiled. We smiled. And with a little further ado, he introduced Peter, whom the other students had not had the good fortune of meeting. Again, don't fucking say that. We get it. If a guy is talking to you about jujitsu on the bus, like obviously... it's not good fortune to meet them. You don't need to say that. That's the problem with this piece. And Pano says that Peter was kicking butt in the righteous name of freedom.
And then here comes my second least favorite section.
Yeah, read this.
So he's describing Peter Boghossian coming onto stage. He says, Peter springs to the center of the room. The air pressure changes. A buzz, a hum, a current about us. He brims with a frenzied energy. Something is happening. He's going to give us a taste of what's to come, he says. This is the kind of intellectual activity we're going to experience at University of Austin. We're going to grapple with big issues. We're going to be daring, fearless, undaunted. We're going, he says, to do something called street epistemology.
Now,
should I keep going? Yeah.
Peter Boghossian talking about street epistemology should be the funniest thing you've ever read in your whole life.
This should have been a 500-word essay about Peter Boghossian's street epistemology. That would be perfect.
Or just a video of Peter Boghossian doing this.
Presented without comment.
There's no comment necessary for this stuff. That's my point.
By the end of this, I'm like, is Peter Boghossian really that bad? Which, again, is a thought that I don't think I should be having. But I'm like, is that so fair? I feel like you could say shit like that about my lecturing style, like in a frantic, spastic manner.
Well, no, say that because we'll get to a point where I think you're really right there. So he says, continuing, what is street epistemology? He'll demonstrate. It's one of two things he does, the other being jujitsu. You know, I'm sure he was very proud of that, like, little callback. I don't have a life, he says. I talk to strangers and I wrestle strangers. I'm sorry.
I'm laughing so hard at your proud of his little callback because it's...
Yeah.
I just pictured him on his laptop looking up and to the left and being like, yeah.
Exactly. Oh, God, they're going to love this. I'm going to get so much pussy from this. Like...
First byline.
I don't have a life, he says. I talk to strangers and I wrestle strangers. Like, I want to believe he really said that, you know, but we have to, like, and if he did, you know, it's funny because earlier he said that he had children.
I know. Seriously, it's serious divorced dad energy. I think that this is why he's doing this.
And apologies to Peter Boghossian's kids if you're listening.
And to divorced dads.
And to divorced dads. But before we do street epistemology, Peter needs to think of some questions. He turns his back to the audience, hunches slightly in stride, stroking his chin. He is Rodin's thinker set in manic motion. He is a relentless logician in his study at midnight. He is a frantically philosophical gremlin. Bam! He wheels around and stalks forward and slings his index finger out towards the student, demands of him whether climate change is real and how certain is he and why. Bop! He turns to another student and asks whether gender is a social construct, whether trans women are women. Exclamation point. Yeah. So it's just like...
Bam and bop are in all caps.
It's like you were saying, there's no comment necessary. There's no, like, over-the-top, mockery necessary. You just have to let him do it. I want to see this. Like, I think this could be one of the most cringiest things you could imagine. And then
and he managed to make his write-up of it even cringier.
Or as cringy. Yeah. But the other thing is, I don't trust any of this, right? Like,
no, I know. I feel like he picked some examples that make it seem extra dumb. I mean, is Peter Boghossian really is street epistemology just pointing at people and yelling while you ask a question? I assume
it's more than that and also like cringier than that. If you actually got it on its own, unremarked
upon. He staggers and weaves as a boxer dances, so Peter lectures. He's the professor you never had. He's a squall of raw intellect. He is Robin Williams in the Dead Poet Society, but ripped. He's putting a gun to the head of your most precious assumptions. I'm done with this. I don't even want to talk about this guy.
It's
like, I'm just done.
I'm done. It's very frustrating. I'm very mad at you, Noah Rawlings. I feel like this needs to be redeemed. I don't want to feel like I have to defend Peter Boghossian. Just a couple of other just facts about it. We won't go down into the...
Like, we're like not even a third of the way through the article.
And it gets more political. And I probably agree substantively with this author on most political issues. Definitely. He seems like he's from a particularly annoying corner of the left. But a couple other guest speakers that were there. Seth Dillon of the Babylon Bee.
Hilarious.
The Onion for like conservatives. So I went to the Babylon Bee today just to see. So they were, I guess his speech was about, you know, how Elon Musk saved comedy by reinstating Babylon Bee to Twitter. Here's the kind of comedy that you can get at the Babylon Bee. the unwoke onion. National Guardsmen being trampled by migrants, glad to hear we're not being invaded. That's their lead headline. Shrek prosecuted after trying to remove squatters from swamp. I guess that's another immigration thing.
Like they've moved on from New Yorker style comics of bathrooms with 10 different gender markers on them and stuff like that. Like that was the hilarity a few months ago.
This is very actually immigrant focused. Mexico begins constructing wall to keep illegal immigrants from coming back is one of them.
That's a little funny.
You think? I don't know. We have different senses of humor. I always thought we had the same.
I'm telling you, it's this article. This article has made me start. Compared to this, that was kind of a zinger.
It's radicalized you. Yeah, you're totally like, you're Nicholas Christakis now. You're going to be Eric Weinstein in like 2 weeks. Like, it's just not funny, right? Women unable to distinguish between basketball and hockey, about to smoke your March Madness bracket again. So the author is taking Katie Royfe's sexual politics course. I guess she's a, like my stepmother, kind of zone of talking about feminism. But then the other three courses are the psychology of morality with Rob Henderson, a would-be Jordan Peterson. He says science and Christianity with geophysicist and IQ fetishist Dorian Abbott, whom you could hear say things like, "I hate feminism," a grin twisting his face. Ugh. Anglo-American grand strategy is the third course taught by Walter Russell Mead. I mean, oh my God.
That's a title that I would use if I didn't want people registered for my class. Like,
so your whole family dies if you don't take one of these courses. Which one do you take?
It's such an easy answer for me.
Yeah.
It's science and Christianity with geophysicist and IQ fetishist Dorian Abbott.
Yeah.
I really want to hear what kind of Christian apologetics I would get in there. Would I get some facts? Like, would he talk about how the flood was proven or something?
He would talk about race and IQ at design.
And I'm definitely already an IQ fetishist, obviously.
Right. IQ fetishist.
I'd be there for the joke.
I just want to see a grin twisting his face as he says, "I hate feminism." Yeah.
Eighth grade English.
Okay,
class.
If that's off the table now, which one do you take?
I don't know, okay, because the psychology of morality, I know too much about it, and I think I would just get bored.
I think it's like probably like earlier. Evo Psych stuff. Like, why is this a forbidden course? I think there's got to be some Evo Psych.
Yeah, with about assortative mating and the ethics of sexuality or something. Because I don't know. Because talking about the prisoner's dilemma and kin selection doesn't seem to be too forbidden.
No, should be forbidden, but
What about you?
I don't think I'm doing that. I agree. Science and Christianity. I want to see some IQ fetishism, but. Then I think I might go the sexual politics course. Like, I think it sounds a little dreary, and I'm sure it would be annoying to be with a bunch of dudes talking with, like, but I still think that, well, I mean, like, Anglo-American grand strategy is off the table by this old, political theorist or something. Like, just sounds brutal. I think I would go with the sexual politics, but it's you're rolling the dice because it could be the worst course.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think we got the right answer, science and Christianity. Yeah. We're always flirting with Christian apologetics anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right. Should we wrap this up then?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. We'll be right back to talk about another clash of equally opposing forces, continental and analytic philosophy. Welcome back to Very Bad Wizards. This is the time where we like to take a moment and thank all of our listeners who reach out to us, who connect with us, and who connect with each other. First off, though, I want to set the record straight. It's now about 5, maybe 6 days since we recorded that opening segment, and Trixie has not had a single accident in all of that time and has just been the most perfect and most snuggly little girl imaginable. So just wanted to say that. Just wanted to defend her honor there. If you would like to reach out to us, you can email us, verybadwizards@gmail.com. You can tweet to us. I am at Tamler, Dave is at Pease, or you can tweet at verybadwizards. You can follow us on Instagram. You can like us on Facebook. You can join the subreddit and give us a 5-star review if you have a moment. Give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. That helps other people who might enjoy the podcast find it who otherwise might not know about it. Oh, and if you have a chance and you're on Letterboxd, please give me a follow there. I've been posting reviews, and I like to connect with listeners on that site. And if you would like to support us in more tangible ways, you can go to our support tab on our website, verybadwizards.com. There you can see you can give us a one-time or recurring donation on PayPal. You can buy some swag, or you can become one of our beloved Patreon supporters. And a lot's going to be going on Patreon. We have a few announcements to make coming up. Probably have to wait till the end of the semester to implement some of that stuff. But for now, there are a bunch of different tiers at $1 and up per episode. You get ad-free episodes all the way back, and you get all 7 volumes of Dave's Beats. Beats without rhymes. Those are awesome. At $2 and up, you're in our bonus tier, so you get a whole archive of bonus episodes, and we have done, I'm sure at this point, well over 100. Of course, including The Ambulators, our detailed episode-by-episode breakdown of the greatest television show of all time, Deadwood. We are about to record Deadwood Season 3, Episode 3. At $5 and up, you get to vote on a listener-selected episode. We do that a couple times a year, and I think it's finally happening. The vote's not done yet, but it's definitely trending in this direction. We are finally going to be doing The Denial of Death. We put it up there so that the listeners could force us to do it if they so chose, and it looks like you have so chosen. At $10 and up, you can ask us a question every month. On our monthly Ask Us Anything episodes, we will answer you in video form, and we release an audio form of that to all of our bonus tier listeners. So thank you so much for all your generous support. We really appreciate it. We depend on it, and soon we're going to depend on it even more. Thank you so much. Let's get back to the episode. All right, let's get to our main topic. Analytic and Continental Philosophy, Explaining the Differences. This is a 2003 article by Neil Levy. Neil Levy, who I've met maybe a couple times, but know primarily from the like golden age of free will, moral responsibility, blogging at the Garden of the Forking Paths and Flickers of Freedom, when like actually like blogs were a way to get yourself out there and meet people. And he was very active there. I was pretty active there. I really look back fondly on those days. They seem innocent, you know, like it's pre-Twitter. It's pre-Facebook being more than just here's what I had for breakfast and here's pictures of my new family, you know. Anyway, so that's how I knew him. I guess he really is writing this at the beginning part of that period. And I had thought he was very young. And I don't know, this doesn't read like a piece by a young philosopher. To really have something interesting to say about this foundational difference right now in the way professional philosophy is practiced doesn't seem like something you could do if you were just starting out. But I actually don't know what his history is.
Well, so yeah, on his website, it says that he got a PhD in continental philosophy in 95 and then a second PhD on the metaphysics of free will in 06. Mm. So I think you're reading it right. Neil Levy has the experience with both.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That qualifies him, I think. And yeah, I think I think you're complimenting the article by saying that, but if you're not, like, I think that that's exactly how it reads to me. Yeah, like it's has the wisdom of somebody who's worked in both of these.
This definitely has something interesting to say about the differences, and I think something maybe especially interesting to say about the way analytic philosophy operates. And we'll talk about that too. So let me just give a little background for people who aren't philosophy grads or majors or who don't know the way professional philosophy works. So you quickly discover, if you're applying for grad programs in philosophy, that there are analytically oriented departments and there are continental oriented departments. And that while a few universities have a handful of both, most of them lean very heavily in one direction. And some, or a lot actually, like my own at Houston, are just analytic. And some are just continental. And the ones you associate with just continental, or at least heavily continental, are like Vanderbilt, Emory, BU, at least in my memory, although I think that's changed a little bit, Boston University. And then the analytic ones are like Rutgers and Michigan and Harvard and MIT. So like paradigmatically, you have these two different kinds of departments, the ones that are focused on continental philosophy and the ones that are focused on analytic philosophy. I went to a place that was only analytic philosophy. There is no continental philosopher there. And as you get raised in this tradition, you, at least if you're being raised in an analytic department, you feel like, okay, this is the one that's kind of coextensive with science. And then there are these freaks over in the continental side, like Derrida and Foucault and Heidegger, who write in extremely obscure prose, very German, very French in terms of, you know, the style of what they're doing. And they're just kind of putting out gibberish and getting laid, to be fair, but like it's still mostly gibberish. And we're doing precise, rigorous thinking. We're actually using logic and reason, all the stuff that you love. And you don't really know because you're never exposed. Like, I never read Foucault. I never read Derrida. I never read Heidegger. I never read Husserl. You know, you would present me snippets of their work. And yeah, it did seem like gobbledygook. But certainly the trajectory of my career has taken me more towards continental philosophy and away from the analytic approach, as thinking that that approach is fruitful. But one thing that I've never really thought about is how to make a real kind of concrete distinction between these two approaches, these two schools, beyond like the cliches and stereotypes that I've been offering. And that's what Neil Levy tries to do in this paper. And not only that, he tries to come up with a kind of explanation for why these differences in the two approaches continues, why it exists. And you were the one who, I think, put it in the Slack. So yeah, what made you want to talk about this?
Yeah, I, you know, of course, I wasn't a philosophy grad student. And the way that I came to even realize that this distinction existed, I think, was just purely by accident. Because as somebody who was doing a psychology major, but nonetheless was interested in philosophy, you know, what philosophy means, what you think philosophy is, turns out to probably be something that continental philosophers are interested in and that analytic philosophers aren't.
Yeah.
So as somebody who was just like, okay, I like philosophy, let me start reading some philosophy. It started with a psychology professor who got me into reading existential stuff. And, you know, I never read Heidegger, like I never read, you know, that hardcore German stuff because it was inscrutable to me. But that's clearly, like, to me, it was clearly linked. It was like a short step away from going to Kierkegaard to going to Heidegger, right? So like I had a professor who loved Heidegger. And so then it was weird that I was just never exposed to really the analytic, or like I should say I never read stuff in the analytic tradition because, again, I was not told that this was stuff I should read until I got to graduate school. And I started taking courses in the philosophy department at Yale because I was interested in just learning more about moral stuff because I wanted to do moral psychology. And there, all of a sudden, I find myself in these classes where it's these puzzle cases and this here's premise one, premise two. And yeah, just as you would predict, Temler, my brain gravitated toward that stuff.
Frege Geech problem as a like objection to non-cognitive.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, okay, but like this is another thing. Like, how would you ever know, right? Unless you're a philosophy student, probably in grad school or maybe a serious major, that there is like this distinction between meta ethics and normative ethics, and that there's like these are all these professional like terms of art that I had no idea. And even then, I think it only at some point dawned on me when somebody said, oh, that's continental philosophy, that, oh, there was a term. For me, it was vibes. Like, I knew there were different vibes to reading Kierkegaard than there was to reading whatever, G.E. Moore or something. And there's where I think that I caught up with you, that what I learned were cliches and stereotypes, and learned that there was a good kind of philosophy and there was the sloppy kind. And the sloppy kind was continental. And yeah, I associated it with French guys in black turtlenecks smoking cigarettes, or weird German idealists. And
like Nazis.
Nazi
sympathizers. You bringing up Kierkegaard is interesting, and maybe just before we get into Levy's argument or his way of trying to explain the difference, I think one of the things that he doesn't address is the kind of 19th century crossover philosophers.
Yeah.
Kierkegaard maybe is more on the continental side, or at least more on the like analytic philosophers are going to ignore you side, and probably with the continentals in that he's very much like a proto-existentialist. But Nietzsche, and to maybe a lesser extent Schopenhauer, and certainly Hegel, very much are in this kind of middle ground where both analytic philosophers and continental philosophers can kind of claim this person and includes them in their work, you know, like in the way in the debate. Now, that might be more recent in analytic philosophy with someone like Nietzsche than it was in the, like the middle of last century, you know, the heyday of a certain kind of very narrowly defined analytic philosophy. But these people who scorn continental philosophy, they don't mean they scorn Kierkegaard, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche. The contempt that they have is for like the people they think are charlatans, like Derrida.
Right, Derrida is a good example.
Yeah, and Foucault, and then there are people like Deleuze, who they just think, okay, like I don't know, maybe there's something interesting here, but I can't make heads or tails of it, you know.
Right.
And then Husserl is where the split is sometimes said to take place, where the followers of Husserl go to continental philosopher, the most prominent one being Heidegger, but Husserl and Frege, like the arch analytic philosophy supervillain.
You mean Frege the superhero?
No, I don't. And I'm also being very loyal to my dad, who hated Frege.
I do.
even though my dad was very much an analytic philosopher in spirit and letter. But anyway, so like Husserl and Frege didn't consider themselves doing different things, right? Like they used to just correspond and like write and like comment on each other's work. But once you get past them, it's like, okay, here's Bertrand Russell, and here's logical positivists, and here's, you know, this one way of approaching philosophy that's very much modeled after the sciences, and then there's Heidegger and Sartre and these other people who are just writing literary criticism and nonsense.
Yeah, which includes people who are doing like psychoanalytic stuff.
That's right.
That got wrapped into it. Yeah.
Very much into the continental tradition.
Yep. And, you know, for our listeners who might be Patreon supporters who are currently voting on a topic, that part of my introduction to all of that tradition really was from the denial of death that tries to tie together existentialism, including Kierkegaard and Freud and you know, an empirical psychology, well, somewhat, into this package. So that is, I learned later, I was reading, I guess, continental-style philosophy.
Wait, so you've read The Denial of Death?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, so I'm really getting fucked.
But I read it in college. Like,
okay.
So yeah. I took a class where we read it as a text for the class.
Oh, cool.
It was fine. You know, I'm curious to see when I go back whether I'll think it's all like hogwash, because I... Maybe.
Because you're so analytically trained now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, now. Now I'm doing. So So people who do history of philosophy or people in classics departments who are trained as philosophers, are those people, does it cut either way? Like, are those people doing history of philosophy one or the other?
So yeah, just to add a little context to this question, continental philosophers typically invoke history and embed their positions within a history of the tradition that they're writing in. Whereas, you know, like, there are plenty of exceptions to this, but analytic philosophers are like, there's no point in going back to Ptolemaic astronomy. Like, we've made progress, and that stuff is only interesting sociologically. You know, maybe, oh, here's some Aristotle stuff that might still be relevant today, but I'm going to talk about it not in the context of the historical circumstances that it emerged, but rather to the extent that it can help my argument, right?
Right. And, is the argument true that Aristotle made in these two pages true or not?
Yeah. And in that way, it's a very impoverished, I think, way of approaching philosophy. And I think the continental philosophers, it can be a little tedious sometimes to go through a whole history, but I think they're right to recognize that historical context matters when you're discussing certain kinds of positions and certain ideas. So your question then presumes that people who study like history would be continentally oriented, and they're not. So the real question is whether they're analytic philosophers or they're their own special weird
group. They're historians.
Yeah, and I think it's that. Yeah. That's my understanding. Okay, so let's go into Levy's argument here.
Yeah, I want to just give him credit for even trying, because I just thought, okay, well, the answer is just like, there's two traditions. It's like West Coast hip hop and East Coast hip hop. Like, I don't know, you know, it's just like, is there really a need to answer this? And as he was writing, I got convinced that no, like, there is something deeper to this.
Totally.
Yeah.
And he says, I'm not going to try to find necessary and sufficient conditions. I get that this is family resemblance. Yes, there are some people even today, like Charles Taylor and Alistair MacIntyre, who kind of have one foot in both camps. But that said, I think we can come up with some way of describing the difference and some explanation for, you know, why that difference has persisted until today and what the causes of that are. He goes through a couple of different possible ways of distinguishing them. One of them is that anti-scientism characterizes continental thought. The continental thinkers have often objected to the hegemony of science in modern culture, insisting that it represents neither the only kind of knowledge nor even the most basic kind. I think that's true. A lot of the kind of paradigmatic continental philosophers believe that what they're doing is prior to science. You know, they're investigating deeper, more fundamental epistemological and ontological questions. And there's nothing that science can do that will, I don't know, undermine their approach, because science is just already one level up from what they're doing. You're already accepting a set of basic epistemological or ontological assumptions when you do science.
That sounds right to me. Again, like, throughout, I will have to like rely on what you say about a lot of this, because I wasn't trained in either of them. But I do, that does sound right. I don't know that I would have characterized it as deeper, but it's definitely contextual. Like, all knowledge is contextual, and science, so the scientific way of understanding the world, is merely one way of many ways to understand the world. And so, yeah.
But it's not just that. It is that, but it's not just that. It's also that the continental philosopher thinks they are examining subjective experience. Like, the thing that you even need before you could even contemplate doing science or understanding what science was. They really think they're investigating, like, consciousness and being and these things that, I don't know if they need to be settled before you do science, but you're certainly already accepting certain assumptions about those questions once you start to do science.
Yeah. I mean, hence the phenomenological. Like.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's why I think phenomenology is, that's where you start to have a more clearly defined difference between the two.
As an aside, by the way, I remember being confused that some continental philosophers were like Kantians. In the same way that some analytic philosophers were Kantians. I'm like, so which is he? But I guess that's just Kant has such an influence.
It gets very confusing when it's like Kant and Hegel, because the questions they're addressing are at these are more like the questions that analytic philosophers address. And I think actually this is where Neil Levy's explanation of this difference, or his characterization of this difference, is actually pretty helpful. My suggestion is this: analytic philosophy has successfully modeled itself on the physical sciences. Work in it is thus guided by paradigms that function in the way that Thomas Kuhn sketches, and the discipline is reproduced in something akin to the way in which sciences are reproduced. Continental philosophy has had a quite different approach to its subject matter, a quite different model of what philosophy is, which guides its characteristics, concerns, and shapes its methods. And this is this analogy that I found actually really enlightening and insightful. The idea is that in analytic philosophy, there is a paradigm that has been established. And it was established, according to Levy, by Frege and Russell. And it is this very logical, analytical, scientifically informed and scientifically modeled approach. Continental philosophy hasn't recognized any kind of paradigm. And so because analytic philosophers have, they think this is the way of doing philosophy, whether it's through conceptual analysis or whether it's through some broader kind of naturalized epistemology, that it's still going to be, I am presenting you an argument to lead to a sound conclusion. And you can get, according to Levy, progress through that along the lines. And I have questions about this, but you can get results and progress when you do normal philosophy, puzzle cases and these counterexamples to puzzle cases and these new theories that can handle those counterexamples. You can kind of operate a whole research program because the basic assumptions of the foundation of what you're doing are accepted and shared.
And it's funny because I think what he's saying seemed to fall out from what I already believed about these two in a way that, again, I had just never been reflective of it. When Levy says, look, if we think about this as a, in this Kuhnian framework, it totally makes sense that all of the things that we think and have been told that characterize analytic philosophy really do, in the sense that they are background assumptions that have been agreed upon. And because of that, you can do kind of ahistorical, acontextual, sort of systematic work that builds on each other, because people just accept that this is the method, right? This is the primary method by which we're going to achieve truth. And so I can take your article. This is another thing that I found fascinating. He says that because of this, analytic philosophers can primarily make their contributions in journal articles, whereas continental philosophers have to write books. I thought that was very...
Totally true. Yeah. You could go your whole career as an analytic philosopher and only write journal articles. And even in Gettier's case, only write one.
Only write a three-page one.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of analytic philosophy books are really a collection of articles.
That's right.
Or lectures, whatever.
Obviously, a lot of exceptions. You know, some of the most famous work in analytic philosophy is in book form, Theory of Justice, you know, Word and Object.
This is not going to be an exhaustive way of describing these. There are exceptions. So yeah, I loved it. Like, I love it to think of continental philosophy as pre-paradigmatic. And because of that, when you have a pre-paradigmatic approach, you can get a lot more originality and novelty in arguments. And you can get people who work on bigger picture stuff that are completely outside of the paradigm of the analytic philosophical tradition. Stuff that doesn't neatly fit into any of the problem space that analytic philosophy has laid out for itself. And stuff that might seem from somebody within analytic philosophy to be gobbledygook. But I think in part because you really have to work hard. You have to work hard to try to understand Heidegger and what he's saying.
Yeah. There's a couple ironies in this characterization. Levy says, number one, like you say, that this allows continental philosopher to actually work on the stuff that people associate with philosophy, like really big questions about the meaning of life and our place in the universe and all of that. And he says, like, analytic philosophy writing is just boring and dry, whereas, like, continental writing is fun and you know, more
and it's like more accessible at some point.
Yeah, that's it's more accessible. And it's like, I you know, this part is the, you know, certainly the best of continental philosophy, or at least the parts that I've been able to connect with, are accessible. But like, if there's one thing that, like, at least according to the stereotypes, they're not as accessible. They're jargon filled and not technical jargon, like that it feels like you could try to figure it out if you cared to. And maybe this is just my prejudice talking, but I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, there, you don't get from Levy in this the kind of caricature of continental philosophy as being actually the quite the opposite of accessible, just obscure even to people who are giving good faith efforts to trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, no, I had that, the same note about the accessible part. And I think Bernard Williams' quote says this, where he says that one of the goals he thinks of analytic philosophy, one of the characteristics, is that it uses moderately plain speech, right?
Yeah. As somebody who has really wanted to connect with continental philosophy, because I've become so skeptical of the paradigm that analytic philosophy is often working with, that it's hard to engage. I have found it like very hard to access what it is that they're talking about, even though I feel in my soul like this is going to be like, if I can grok this, as you would say, like I will agree with it, or at the very least it will inspire me to like understand something about this problem that I'm thinking about. So, you know, I do think there's some jargon in continental philosophy. If we read Derrida or Deleuze, it's not normal science, though, but a set of terms and a set of ideas that you need to have down if you're going to figure out what's going on in some of that work.
Right. There is a comfort that comes from this paradigmatic nature of analytic philosophy, where I can easily like turn to a philosopher in the analytic tradition and ask them to explain what is meant by internalism in moral philosophy. And they can just tell me, like, well, it's very clear what it means.
I think the problem with analytic philosophy in that respect is really the problem with normal science, when they reach a certain point. It is very comforting and it's nice and people can understand each other. But when you start to have, as I think it is easy to have, real doubts about the paradigm you're working within, then analytic philosophy has a hard time dealing with that, right? This is one of the characteristics of normal science, which is that when you start digging too deep into the foundational assumptions of their paradigm, the normal science is very ill-equipped to address that and often will have a lot of obstacles or barriers in the way of doing that. And they won't all be obvious. It's not like you're going to be kicked out of your university if you start asking these questions. It'll just be much harder for people to figure out a way of launching these objections within that paradigm, because the paradigm is in part defined by already accepting the assumptions that you're questioning. And the methodology is built around those assumptions. So it's very hard within that methodology to raise some of these questions. We don't have a good way of evaluating the effectiveness of those critiques, and we especially don't have a good way of evaluating alternative approaches to the paradigm. I mean, I guess by definition.
Yeah, so here's the part that I'm sure, as I was reading it, I was sure you were going to disagree with, which is he says that what he worries about is that maybe it's the case that analytic philosophy actually just does better with novel ideas, because when a novel idea does get proposed, it pops out more clearly, even though it might take time, it might take effort to break through the paradigm. He says continental philosophy, maybe they're just basking in so much novelty that it's just hard to actually tell when something... Is that how you understand his concern?
I mean, and it might be right. Like, again, I'm like not familiar enough with continental philosophy to know whether or not that's a good critique. I mean, my disagreements with the piece are more that he thinks analytic philosophy can be said to make progress in the way that like paradigmatic sciences normal science can say to make progress. But what he says about continental philosophy is it's hard for me to judge because I'm just not familiar enough with it.
Okay, let's talk about the progress thing, because I, believe it or not, had a similar concern about this, which is I buy that analytic philosophy has modeled itself on natural science, and I buy that there are these paradigms. I buy that Russell and Frege and all those people who started this whole approach laid the foundation. Is it progress, or is it the illusion of progress? Or is it even an illusion of progress? Because it's a very different thing to say, as scientists say, we know more now than we did before. Whereas philosophers might say, well, by progress, we just mean we clarified the questions or whatever.
Yeah, that's actually, like, I think, a key question. And I think, so when it comes to real logical analysis, like hardcore logic that was done in the beginning and middle of the 20th century, they got results. They weren't just bouncing ideas back and forth in a bankrupt pseudo problem kind of way. They were, I don't understand them. I'm not sure I would like what the value of that progress is, but it is actual results. You know, you have proofs, and these proofs sometimes can have, pretty serious implications for other fields. And so I think it's fair to say that they have progress. When it comes to something like metaethics, when it comes to something like even justice, I don't see how you can say that we've made progress in a non-question-begging way. You can say you've made progress politically. You can say the Civil Rights Act was progress, but that has nothing to do with, like, analytic philosophy progress. And when it comes to, like, do we have a better understanding of motivational internalism, is that progress, or is that just we've been jerking ourselves off in new and different ways, but we're not actually shedding light on the world and the human experience? I don't know. If you think it's a pseudo problem, like the concept of knowledge or something like that, then there's no way to say that that's progress. It's just progress and wasting people's time.
Right. So, well, a couple things. One, I totally agree with you about the progress that was made by those early guys. But I feel, I'm pretty sure that they hit a wall, that they themselves,
that's right,
Russell himself was like, fuck, you know, Kurt Gödel comes along and he fucks me. And he's right, right?
Yeah.
Or Wittgenstein comes along and he fucks everybody and he's right, or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And so then the remainder of analytic philosophy that was sort of built on that methodology has adopted the form of those methods without really, I'm sort of speaking out of my ass, so bear with me, but it has adopted the form of that early work. And you can see that in the way that that they write their papers often, but it's not come to terms with the sort of bankruptcy of that project, as the authors of that project themselves admitted.
That's true.
The other thing I was going to say is, when I think about progress, and here's where I want to ask you directly about, well, but, like, gun to your head, is the work on free will from 50 years ago, can you say that the work on free will now hasn't made something that you would call progress? And if that progress might just be that we're more precise in laying out the problem space?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And so here's the thing. This is where, like, my whole anti-analytic philosophy stance, which is only probably like 10% shtick, and something that I've really had for a long time. I've been skeptical of certainly a lot of the philosophical problems that are dominant within analytic philosophy. But I think in the free will debate is so much better. I don't know about now, but I think it was so much better starting from the 70s to the early 2000s than it really was at any point in the history of philosophers talking about this. I do think, like, you have someone like Strawson come along and say something that nobody has ever said about the free will, moral responsibility debate, including, like, the existentialists, including my heroes like Diderot and, you know, Spinoza on it, like, really came up with something that was truly original, that I think is actually mostly right. It's very interestingly unanalytic paper in that it doesn't lay out arguments in a precise way and nobody can totally agree upon what he was actually saying. But
yeah,
it's a dominant piece within analytic philosophy. It's not a continental piece. It's a work of analytic philosophy, and it's been treated that way. And I think a lot of the literature on it is misguided or misunderstands what Strawson was getting at, but a lot of the literature is really good. You know, you have the Gary Watson paper with the Robert Harris paper. That's a great paper that adds its own little spin. And so there is room. You know, it's funny to say make progress. Like, yeah, to understand the problem of freedom and responsibility, if that's the goal, then we understand it better, I think, because of the way analytic philosophers have approached it. And I'm sure, like, Bergson also would give us a lot to think about if I could, you know, immerse myself in his view of freedom. But, like, the free will moral responsibility debate, for all my frustrations with, you know, the theorizing and the overly systematic approach and the, like, almost willful misunderstandings of what Strawson was trying to tell everybody, that whole literature is at the center of the analytic philosophy debate on free will and moral responsibility. And I think, you know, I certainly feel like my understanding of that problem is much richer because of that literature.
Right. And that way of putting it, the understanding of the problem, I guess, must be the kind of progress that Levy must be talking about or that analytic philosophers are aiming to achieve, right?
Sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think they don't conceive of themselves that way. They're like, oh, I just proved moral realism is true.
Right, because it's interesting, like, when I hear you talk about your annoyance with the systematicity and all the other things, the trappings of analytic philosophy, I guess now I'm realizing sometimes it's not clear whether you think, given what you just said about the free will problem, it seems as if those methods did yield something valuable and interesting. So it's hard to tease apart what you might think are just dumb problems to begin with.
Right.
Like, maybe we do know a lot more about how people use the term knowledge, but did we need to?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think there's two different issues with analytic philosophy. Sometimes it's just they're working on a pseudo problem. Sometimes it's that they're working on a potentially really interesting problem, but in a overly dry or overly systematic way, which is, I think, often my problem, even with the free will and moral responsibility debate. This is where I'm very torn. I think there are resources within analytic philosophy to express that kind of frustration that I have. And maybe right, it's hard, but it's through doing that that I feel like I understand the issue better. You know, I always go back to this. I remember I asked Susan Wolf, who is, I think, a really good example of both an accessible analytic philosopher and one who typically writes on a lot of the big questions. I asked her, do you think we theorize too much in philosophy? Don't you think, like, that kind of overly theoretical approach is misguided? And she said, no, I don't think it's a problem that we come up with theories. I think the problem is thinking that your theories are true. And so what I take from that is it's not the theorizing that the problem, if you understand it in a certain way, and that way is theories are a way of exploring the problem and trying to more clearly define the problem and understand the problem and understand the questions and enrich the questions. They can't be solved, though. Like, the puzzle-solving approach of analytic philosophy sometimes presumes that you're going to get at the truth. And that's not something that philosophy can do well. But the theorizing itself, as long as it doesn't have that pretense, can be pretty useful and illuminating.
Yeah, that's why I think we like Nagel's Mortal Questions essays so much. It's really a case of doing philosophy in a way where it means very literally just asking the questions and not presuming to have an answer that he arrived at through those methods. It's also, interestingly, not that analytical.
Yeah.
I mean, Thomas Nagel is so obviously an analytic philosopher.
You know what he's not doing is operating within normal science. You know, he's starting from scratch. You know, like, in that way, it could be a lot more continental in that he's building from the ground up there. You know, he's talking about the absurd. He may reference Camus. He may reference a couple other people, but really he's just writing about the problem, not from an established paradigm.
Yeah, but I do get the sense that having come from the established paradigm makes him clearer, you know?
I agree.
One thing we haven't really talked about is the comparison that Levy makes between continental philosophy and just art.
Yeah.
Which is another interesting one.
So, yeah. Again, it's like, I think it's certainly continental philosophers are more interested in art and incorporate art and literature and film into their work in ways that analytic philosophers don't. I think analytic philosophers can be Philistines about art, and continental philosophers at least actually really engage with the literature. It's just that sometimes, again, it can be fruitful and sometimes it can be really obscure and actually very theoretical, you know? Like, it's out of continental philosophy that a lot of the post-structuralist approaches that are actually pretty reductive of art, you know, either reductive politically or reductive according to some new theory that they're working with for interpretation. So it's complicated, you know, whereas then I feel like the analytic philosophers are at least using that as an example, and maybe they oversimplify it and maybe they're just treating it as a thought experiment, but at least they're not trying to drain it or explain it in the way that sometimes the continental philosophers can try to do. And maybe that's more literary theory than continental philosophy, but there's a lot of overlap between those two.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Here's what maybe we could close on this question. Do you think that there is a similar kind of distinction you could make in psychology? And I'll give you the reasons for why I'm asking this question. So on the one hand, you have the social psychologists working within normal psychology, you know, with your methods and your hypothesis testing and your metrics, your forms of measurement and all of that. It operates according to those rules. And then you have, parallel to this, you have psychoanalysis, you have Gestalt theory, you have, analytic psychology, which is actually associated with Jungian views, that just seem more offbeat, more Marxist adjacent in the way that continental philosophy can kind of be Marxist adjacent, and also to interact with literature, at least to make that more central to their understanding of the human mind than social psychologists do, which is usually just reduced to the opening line of a social psychology article. It's like, in West Side Story, Officer Krunky says, you know.
Crunk you. No, I think that's exactly right. So much, Tamler, to the point that when you were asking, I was struggling to see what this might be. And then when you brought up psychoanalytic stuff, I was like, oh, I forgot that was psychology. And there is there is something that I think is super interesting that happened in psychology, where that huge divide kicked out those kinds of analysis. Like, everything that you might say was birthed by psychoanalytic theory, it got kicked out of psychology departments in a way that they found their home in like whatever literary theory and all that stuff. And to some extent in clinical psychology.
To a large extent, right? There's a big psychoanalytic.
Yeah. For sure, as a method of treatment. But just to distinguish it between, like, I guess, clinical science.
Yeah.
Which is what the kind of psychology that you would learn.
Right.
If you were to go to any university and take a course in clinical psychology, you would very much be within the paradigm of psychological science. You know, social psychology right now is so built on the paradigm that really came out of cognitive psychology and all of that stuff that came from everything from psychophysics to perception and all that stuff. So much so that we call it social cognition nowadays. And the other stuff just got squeezed out. And this does, I think, illustrate a point that I was thinking about that Levy makes, which I think can sociologically help to explain why that happened. And it's what he says about, and I guess borrowing from Kuhn, that paradigmatic normal science is self-reproducing in a way that the other stuff really isn't. And both in analytic philosophy and in psychology, you can become a graduate student and just be introduced to this specific problem and then use all the methods to work on that problem.
Right.
So you know when you come in and you start thinking about what you're going to do for your dissertation,
yeah.
you kind of already know what the problem space is and how you might go about doing it
yeah.
in a way that lends itself really nicely to pumping out PhDs.
Yeah, and punching out articles.
Yeah, in a way that's like, I don't know, you know, I guess in continental philosophy, you learn how to make contributions that way, but I suspect that that's probably why analytic philosophy took over philosophy so hardcore. Not because it was yielding more truth, but because it's just like a reproduction machine in a way that the other kind can't be.
100%, yeah. Yes. Because it gives people a way of like a set of somewhat objective criteria, like is this argument yeah. good? Like did they provide right. enough evidence for this premise?
And I can evaluate like the work of a psychologist right. on a committee that doesn't do what I do, but I can use my tools to evaluate whether their work is good or not. Like it's not too hard. So long as I understand some of their, you know, specific methods or terms of art or whatever, I can say whether it's good or bad in a way that I don't, you know.
The one way I thought it might be disanalogous is that psychoanalytic theory is itself a pretty well-defined paradigm, right? And that there are people who work in that tradition who have kind of built on Freud's ideas, maybe broke with him on a couple of things, but carried it forward. And, you know, and there's a lot of psychoanalytic approaches to politics and art. And it does feel like they are working within the paradigm, even if it's not at all the paradigm that scientists are working within.
Yeah. I don't know what that the answer to that, the right answer is. I was talking to Nikki about this article, and she was saying something about it's wrong to think that continental philosophers aren't also working in a paradigm. And in my defense of Levy, I was saying, well, I think if you mean by paradigm a bunch of widely shared assumptions and methods, then no. But if you just mean like a knowledge base, some shared beliefs, then maybe. But that's not, I think, what Kuhn or Levy mean by paradigm. And I think Levy makes this point that I also found really interesting, where he says that this is why continental philosophy talks more about individual authors. So like the currency is to talk about what does Foucault think about this,
right?
Not what is the finding in this domain. And I think psychoanalytic stuff is somewhere in between, where if you say you're a psychoanalytic theorist, people might want to know right away, are you a Freudian? Are you a Jungian? Are you this or that? Like it's more acolyte kind of, you know, let's extend, because obviously not everybody can reinvent the wheel.
Right.
But they kind of will choose which school. And by school, it's really like this person's work is central or not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mark Hughes.
Yeah, you know, right.
Someone like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's right. And that's very analogous in that way to continental philosophy.
I remember a jarring time where one of the only times I gave a talk in an interdisciplinary place where there were plenty of people from the continental tradition and from the psychoanalytic tradition, and even from like the kind of anthropology that's more a humanity than it is a science. And I gave my talk, which was just very straightforwardly, here's my studies,
yeah.
you know, here's my measures. And the questions were like, what do you think a Foucauldian approach to this would be? And I was like, I was so confused. I was like, can you tell me what he thought about this? And then maybe I can tell you what I would say. I thought this was just name dropping, you know?
I went out in my fourth year. I don't know why I thought I could get a job after my fourth year of PhD, but I did get an interview with the University of Denver. And that was a very continentally oriented department, and I was just doing my free will skepticism, you know, my just naive, like,
yeah,
there's no free will. It's all genetics and environment, and I'm going to do an error theory of why you believe there's free will, because like evolutionary explanation for that. I don't know why they gave me an interview, but I do remember that exact question coming from one of the committee members, and he was not being a dick. He was just like, Deleuze said, like, you know, you talk about Spinoza and what Spinoza, like, have you read Deleuze on Spinoza and his whole analysis? And I had never heard that name in my whole life. That was the first time I had ever heard the word Deleuze spoken.
Right.
But that was considered to be a legitimate legitimate question because I guess it, you know, there are certain foundational figures, even if there's no paradigm, that people have to talk in the context of. Maybe that's part of their historically oriented approach. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, do you think this article was continental or analytical?
It's pretty analytical. Here's where you can tell that it's analytic. This essay will fall into two parts. In the first, I shall examine some recent attempts to characterize analytic and continental philosophy, hereafter AP and CP, respectively. That's not something you would see in a continental yeah. piece. I shall suggest that all fail to state necessary and sufficient conditions that could function as criteria with which to count. Indeed, there are no such criteria, or so I shall contend. If, like right there, that sentence. Indeed, there are no such yes. criteria, or so I shall contend. You wouldn't find that in a continental.
No, no, it's true. Even you're right, the AP and the CP, the yeah. minute I read that, I was like, oh, okay. You can't be bothered to write analytic so many times.
It is funny that you don't find that in continental. They just don't do that. You don't just start taking words away and putting letters in their place.
Right. The longer the word, the better
yeah,
for them.
Exactly. So that's the German influence, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. That's the analytic continental tradition. I want to be more into continental than I am.
Well, you know, we just need to pick a text, I think.
I agree. Yeah.
And dive into it.
Yeah. Well, Schopenhauer is not going to win, but I think we're going to get to Schopenhauer. That can be like our little step. You know, one of the questions I had in my notes is like, where do the pragmatists fit in this? Like James and Dewey and like, or like Peirce or somebody, you know, like they also seem like they have foots in both camps, in yeah. both style and the kind of substance of
work. For sure, because the divide came later, yeah. like I could see both camps claiming some of them. Yeah.
And so James, both camps ignore James. Them all. Like the actual fact yeah, is that both knows. Camps ignore them. Yeah.
Social psychology uses James's opening lines all the time.
Yeah, but not in philosophy, not that much.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Well, that's it from us on philosophy and psychology bonus. Join us next time on Very Bad Wizards.
Very bad wizard.